You're listening to the Trekmate Family Network.
The Battle Bridge is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com.
War, Solus, Sue, report to the Battle Bridge. I'll join you in a moment.
Ensign, secure connector levels.
Aye, sir.
Crusher, Carteno, Gleason, report to the Battle Bridge.
Mr. Data, Mr. Worf, I have a special mission for you.
Note in ship's log that at this start time, I'm transferring command to the Battle Bridge.
You're listening to The Battle Bridge, a TNG podcast where we discuss everything about Star Trek The Next Generation. Tonight's episode is The Vengeance Factor. I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And the synopsis for tonight's show is the Enterprise tries to negotiate an end to raids launched by a group called the Gatherers, but a murder threatens to prevent peace. This is the ninth episode of Season 3 of Star Trek The Next Generation, and the original release date was the 20th of November, 1989. It was written by Sam Wolfe and directed by Timothy Bond. Guest stars tonight include Lisa Wilcock as Yuta, Joey Oresko as Brule, Nancy Parsons as Maruk, and Stephen Lee as Chorga. So, what do we think about this episode? Now, I have to say that I have very strong memories of this episode. When I was growing up, I kind of picked up my knowledge around season 2-3, as I suppose everyone is aware already. And I actually, for whatever reason, I seem to have a soft spot on this episode. I think watching back critically, it's probably not a great episode, but I do enjoy it. I like what they're trying to do in terms of the scope of the story that they have. However, rewatching, I really wasn't a fan of the Riker subplot. But how about you, Lou?
Well, I do like having Mark Lawrence as Volnoth here. And I even kind of dig Elkanah Burns as Tamarack. So if you're not going to introduce him, I am. And Mark Lawrence, by the way, hey, what's going on? Remember this episode in DS9? Show me the money! I think it was Zemo. Yeah, Carl Zemo. So if you remember when the crew robbed the casino, and everybody would love to rob a casino. Okay.
Actually, sorry, I've just usually I don't do the co-guest stars or the co-stars or whatever, but anyway, I wasn't aware that he had been on Deep Space Nine, but I've actually just looked him up, and he wasn't wearing that much makeup, was he?
No.
In this episode.
No, but he almost sounded the same. He's got the same cleft lip. So he has a Rocky Balboa lip. I don't know if that makes any sense. But, okay, I like this episode. I actually do like the Riker and Yuta relationship because it starts out where I think Riker's putting the Riker maneuver on her, and it comes out to where he's trying to help her and guide her or, you know, work through her pain. So I kind of think it's pretty good.
Okay. I mean, we did mention off air before we got on. Isn't she a bit young to be on the receiving end of a Riker maneuver?
No, she's older than Riker is.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I mean, because she's been stopped from aging, I suppose.
Exactly. You know, so,
know that makes it right.
Well, maybe, maybe not, but I suppose that, had she not been vaporized, as Chekhov might say, you know, once she kills the bad guy, or, Chorgon? Is that his name? Yeah. Once she kills him, what is she going to do after that? I mean, so, I don't know, but anyway.
She would have been 25 when filming this.
Yes.
So I suppose it's not that bad. I think she looks relatively young for a 25-year-old.
She's pretty. Yeah, I think she's very cute. Okay, so we're going to start the show in a ransacked ransacked science station, where two scientists were found unconscious after being hit repeatedly by phasers on stun. Now, didn't we establish that you can kill somebody after shooting them multiple times on stun? Or maybe not.
Well, I don't know if it's established, but it kind of makes sense, right? I mean, you're gently hitting someone on the head, eventually you're pretty going to kill them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I would assume multiple hits on stun is just as powerful as kind of, you know, one hit on a fuller beam, which is always something that confuses me. Often they do try to stun something once, and in fact there's a little bit of this at the end of the episode. You get stunned once and you don't quite get knocked over, so they up the beam and then they try again, and at that point it's lethal. I think that if you had just shot people multiple times on a lower setting, mm-hmm. it's probably going to be just as damaging, but without the, you know.
Yeah, I'm sorry, they don't normally vaporize them, though.
Yeah, without the evaporation. I've got notes on the evaporation as we get to it later.
Yeah, I mean the little maybe powders of her on the ground, or but anyway. So there's a blood sample on a makeshift knife, and get this, it's Acomerian.
She didn't know that it was Acomerian straight away, but it was not human. That was clear.
Right. So that suggests the Gatherers. What the hell kind of stupid name is a Gatherers? You can't answer that.
No, it's just, yeah, I think it's a relatively stupid name, but, you know, whatever. You would have... I don't know, do you have a... Does the group have ownership of that name once, you know, it's obviously something that someone probably calls them, but even if what they call themselves, it would have been translated into English. So by that point, they probably don't even know that it sounds silly.
Right.
Now, I have to say, one thing I like about the teaser, one of the notes I have, I think it's a relatively unrepresentative teaser in the sense that it makes you think that you're going one way, and you don't really go that way at all, right? There's the only reason for the teaser is to introduce you into this situation, and pretty much, you know, the threat or the mystery around them of who they are, or the threat of them hitting Federation targets, gets completely removed, you know, 3 or 4 seconds into the main part of the episode. So it's a bit of one of the problems I had was that I think that the story is nice, what they're trying to tell. I don't know if they know how to get the Enterprise into that story. So they have this very weird teaser that then just lands you into these peace negotiations, and then effectively we step back, which is, you know, I suppose it is what it is, but I thought it wasn't as elegant as it could have been.
Right.
But anyway, sorry, one thing I was going to say about the teaser is that, and this is, you know, everyone knows I'm a big Data fan, and I like Data a lot. And also, growing up, I related to Data because I wasn't the Worf kind of guy. I was always the like nerdy kind of guy. And I love the fact that Data in this episode completely shows Worf up with the strength challenge. And whenever they do that, whenever they have the big guy trying to open the door or trying to bend the pipe, and then he can't do it, and Data just walks on and goes, choop, and does it for him, I'm always a big fan of.
Yeah. I wonder what goes through Data's head as he watches him try and open a door. Give it your best shot, big guy. You done?
Yep.
Okay, I'll take care of this. So, okay. But that was a lot of blood on that knife, so I'd say somewhere there's a Gatherer really hurting or dead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. There was a lot. I mean, absolutely was a lot, because otherwise you would have just, you know, dribbled off and stuff. Unless it's particularly thick blood or sticky.
Okay. So now it's time to set course for the Acomar system, where we're going to visit the Sovereign, Maruk. She ends up in the Observation Lounge, and we get to speak with Beulah Ballbreaker. But, you know, I thought I've been talking about Beulah Ballbreaker enough. I'm going to play some audio from Porky's here. Hopefully I can find something that's playable on the show. But if I can find it, I'll put it right here.
Now, Mr. Carter, I know this is completely unorthodox, but I think this is the only way to find that boy. Now, Now that penis had a mole on it. I'd recognize that penis anywhere. In spite of the juvenile snickers of some, this is a serious matter. That seducer and despoiler must be stopped. He's extremely dangerous. And, Mr. Carter, I'm certain that everyone in this room knows who that is. He's a contemptible little pervert who's...
Mr. Boundbreaker.
Well, I'm sorry. But I've got him now, and I'm not going to let him slip through my fingers again. Now, all I ask is that you give me 5 lives for you... minutes. The coaches can be present. Tommy Turner and any 4 boys you see fit to choose. And we can put a stop to this menace. And it is a menace. What are you going to do about it?
Five young boys in the nude. A police lineup. So that you can identify his tallywhacker. Please, can we call it a tallywhacker? Penis is so personal. Penis is so personal.
We can put hoods over their heads to avoid embarrassment. Now listen, we have got to do it as distasteful as it is. I know it's him. That tallywhacker had a mole on it. And that mole is the key to it.
Miss Fabrica, do you realize the difficulty of your request? Now, I would be very happy to apprehend the young man myself. But can you imagine what the Board of Education would say if you were granted a lineup in order to examine their private their private parts for an incriminating mole.
But Mr. Carter.
Mr. Carter. Mm-hmm. I think I have a way out of this. We call the police and we have them send over one of their sketch artists. And Miss Ballbreaker can give a description. We can put up wanted posters all over school. Have you seen this prank? Report immediately to be with Miss Ballbreaker. Do not attempt to apprehend this prick, as it is armed and dangerous. It was last seen hanging out in the girl locker room at Angel Beach High School.
Okay, so now we get a little history. The Acomars were once savage species where clans battled clans, and the Gatherers broke off from Acomar before the change in their society took effect. So the Gatherers are still living in the old ways, and it's now time to bring them home. Maruk thinks this is a waste of time. Well, Picard, obviously, you know, the only reason we're involved is because they got one of our stations. Otherwise, you'd be on your own. But he believes that it's possible. What do you think? I mean, do you think these people that they live on their own, they make their own rules, they do what they want to do, they don't answer to anybody, now they're going to come home, take this piece of land, live under somebody else's rule, and as she tried, not even be part of the rulemaking process? I don't think I'd go for it.
Okay, so if you want me to think about it in terms of the actual people within, you know, in-universe, I think that, you know, these guys have only been away for, you know, 3 generations or so, you know, top. So I can easily see them wanting, to come back, and they don't want to, like, have this existence out in space, you know, finding junk on cargo ships or whatnot. So I think that, you know, I'm willing to buy this as a peace effort. Realistically, the story it's trying to tell, it's not one of, you know, what would happen if some dudes were out in space doing their own thing. It's much more of a, you know, what happens when, you know, there's various factions in a country, and how do you kind of bring it back, you know, some type of how do you have some type of peace process to get that into a more unified state, and how do you, you know, how can you bring everyone into the fold to live under the, you know, the new peace and whatnot. So I like, you know, I'm actually a quite big fan of what they're trying to do here, and I think that what they are attempting to do is probably greater than what they actually managed to achieve. Yeah, I can certainly buy this. I don't think that we should be too cynical at this stage.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. It just seems like the, obviously the other people don't want to, but if Torgon calls for it, they're going to follow. But I don't know. It just seems tough for me. I think some gatherers would still resist it and go out and stay out on their own.
So. I mean, in the UK, we've had pretty much, and it's always not necessarily perfect, but we had pretty much elimination of terrorism from Northern Ireland. And it's, you know, you have had people that have grown up, and people were, I know it's not quite the same thing, but you had people involved with the terrorist activities and, you know, the IRA and whatnot for, you know, for decades and decades. And it does need, at a certain point, it does need a shift. I think that, you know, one thing that often kind of pushes the guys that are displaced from coming back is that what you actually realize is that the ultimate goal of what you're looking for is not necessarily the reason why you're staying away anymore. So, you know, whatever the reasons why the gatherers actually ended up going out, it could possibly be that the society is now much more prepared to accept them. Or, you know, maybe after thinking for 100 years in space, not doing anything, they realize that these demands or the reasons why they left were really not that important in the first place.
Hmm. Okay.
But I have to say, I think that, you know, as I tried to mention pretty comically at the beginning, it's this scene that kind of shifts this episode from it being about something about the Federation needing to do something. And it really much very, very quickly becomes just an internal affair issue. So we, from this point onwards, we see the negotiations between these two factions. We don't see, you know, we're not there as anything other than hosts or as, you know, as helpers in a way. We're not there to force the peace. And it's interesting in that regard. We're not the, you know, we're almost a bystander in this story that takes place in front of us.
Yes, right. Although, you know, Picard becomes a mediator.
Yep, sure. But had they not reached peace, or had they not chosen to, you know, do what they ended up doing, then the Enterprise just flies off the next week, and we just have to arm our space stations or our outposts a little bit more. It's not really that important for the Federation. So I do kind of have a real soft spot for what they are attempting to do here, because it's not really our, you know, not really our concern. But we stay and we have a look and we help nudge, and again, I suppose Riker is critical in the entire process, but it's a small isolated story in a way.
Yeah. Okay, well, it's time to get underway and look for those rascal gatherers, but first Maruk needs to bring aboard two more servants, because obviously the manservant she's with isn't good enough. I got a feeling he was pretty much her security.
Yes, that's right. He didn't come across as, you know, the chef or anything like that.
No, which she really didn't need the chef. That's an interesting part. She didn't need the chef. Just program the stuff in the replicator. But I get, you know, I don't know. The replicator thing bothers me. It's going to bother me next week, too. Okay. When we talk about the... Well, that would require the molecular structure of the beverage in question, yep. Which we don't have.
I'm much more in line with next week's episode than this week's, because here, basically, they are saying that, you know, this woman wants to make some, you know, some fancy thing of a particular root vegetable on their planet, and apparently we have the genetic information for it, which is a little unlikely. So the idea of them, I can understand using a replicator to, like, you know, make it sweet, make it different colors, you know, make the texture in a certain way. But the idea of going, you know, let's say, Lou, you got abducted overnight by a starship, and it was on a, you know, not a Federation ship that had any involvement in Earth, but it was an alien starship, but they had a replicator. Mm. And then you said, you know, what I really want, I want some, you know, fried chicken. Would you be able to tell them how to synthesize fried chicken in a way that would be anything close to what you'd actually be getting on Earth? I think the information there is just so... How would you be able to explain it to them?
That is so true, because today I'm making cheese manicotti for dinner, and I've already made the stuff so I can do the show, and then I'm going to go upstairs and cook it. So I'll have dinner about midnight your time. But the point is that it'd be easy enough if I say, well, the way I make it is I use lasagna noodles. I soften them, and then I roll them up into manicotti shells instead of using manicotti shells, because those things fall apart and you pretty much end up with the same thing anyway. The problem is I could tell them, you get some lasagna shells, soften them up, put some ricotta, mozzarella, parmesan, some parsley flakes, a little garlic salt, some pepper, put it all together. But the problem is then you got to tell the computer how the noodles are made. You know? So how do you make, how can I make ricotta cheese and mozzarella cheese and Parmesan cheese? Because then I have to tell that alien computer how to make Parmesan cheese and how to make ricotta cheese. So you're right. It's not that simple. But he makes it simple. So the two other servants that come aboard. One, I'm not exactly sure what her role is. It never got said. Well, his role never got said either. But then we brought the chef on board. We're pretty much, you know, the first female looks pretty old. Riker's not going to be interested in that. But then we get a cherubic sperm magnet that comes on board. And it took all of 5 seconds before Riker was hitting on her. He was all over her pots and pans. Of course, now, did you hear what I called her earlier? The cherubic sperm magnet?
Yes.
There's one you don't hear very often.
Well, probably more often than you'd expect. Okay, so last week I moaned about the Troy relationship. I think it would not be appropriate for me not to mention the Riker relationship here, because I don't think it's that much better. I really don't. I think it's painful as he goes after her. And I think that he probably shouldn't ethically be able to go after her on the grounds that she is a servant and he is a person in authority. And I think they should probably lock him up for this.
Yes, right. And, you know, haven't they learned anything from Trip Tucker? You know, he should have been able to call that up in history and say, well, he screwed her up. But you're right, to this sense that I didn't like Riker hitting on her instantly. I thought that was pretty bad. But I do like the idea that he completely shifts gears and became her counselor as it progressed on. And speaking of the counselor... Was she absolutely useless in this one? What did Marina actually collect a paycheck for? She had a couple bits of Parthos, and then she was done.
Okay, sure. But am I correct in thinking that Geordi wasn't in this episode at all? Because I can't remember him being there.
Yeah, I suppose not. It really didn't. We didn't need an engineering solution of the day.
No, and you are right that perhaps you did need more. Again, I've been a big fan of when they use Troy, not as a counselor or a therapist, but much more of a kind of like a help to the diplomatic storylines. And in an episode like today, there's a lot of diplomacy going on, and there's probably a lot of insight that can be given by someone who is a diplomat. Mm. And indeed, Picard fulfills that role.
Right.
To the extent that he needs to. I have no idea why Troy is not affected at his side, even if it's just to back him up, because as a professional in that field, she should be.
Not only that, She should have had her red alert antenna up saying, that girl, there's something wrong with her. She is not who she says she is. She's not here for the reason she says. There is something wrong with that girl. But no, she keeps her mouth shut on the bridge. She just sits there, makes faces, then goes to 10 forward, eats some Parthos, and excuses herself from pretty much for the rest of the episode. So, I mean, and oh, then...
That was so uncomfortable when Utah went over to Riker and they're sitting there trying to try her specialty meal. And then Troy has to excuse herself whilst she's sitting down and probably was first to the table in the first place. It's, I mean, honestly, if I were Troy, I would not let Riker get away with this kind of stuff. I would have sat there and watched them and right. be the third wheel.
And then, yeah, right. And then, you know, he looks at Troy like, you wouldn't mind leaving, would you? And of course she gets up. But here's another thing. When Utah's having all these problems, you know, why didn't Riker go to Troy? I mean, you know, maybe help her.
No, you're absolutely right. And I haven't thought about it. And you can obviously see that the Utah character is not actually just one-dimensional, right? She is multifaceted. I think she's actually a relatively well-written character in a way, in the sense that I get the impression she is trying to escape from kind of like her mission, but she also acknowledges she has to honor, you know, the commitment. So I think that she is complicated. As a result, you would expect the empathic counselor sitting mere feet away from her to be able to sense this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very good point. I didn't see this.
Her telepathy circuit burned out today. They're waiting for Starbase 25 to send her a new one. So, OMG, as my daughter says. Riker is asking Utah what her special dishes are, and she says she has none. So he moves in closer, says, come on. You've got to have something, baby. Well, there is Parthos. You know, and that wacky Riker comes up with Parthos Aleuta. So then I was thinking, what if you replace the A with an O? So instead of Parthos, you would have Porthos. So what would Utah's specialty then be? Beagle stew, beagle chops, beagle fingers, fried beagle kebabs. Can you think of any beagle meals?
I think the beagle kebab would be probably the one to go for. It needs to hide the origins of the original meat.
Yes. You could never look at that face and then cook it. Not possible. So you'd have to have the replicator give you the beagle parts that you need. But then would you still do it?
Yeah, I was about to say. Okay, so with replicated food, you move away from any idea of, you know, the ethical side of slaughtering an animal. And, you know, they're obviously, for whatever reason, they're animals that, you know, we're more comfortable to farm and to eat. And there are other animals that we're less comfortable to to either farm and to eat, whether it's, you know, a chimp or dog or whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you think people in the 24th century partake in dog sandwiches and stuff?
Oh, God.
I think that's...
I doubt it.
Okay, good.
I doubt it because my motto is anything that licks me, I'm not eating. You know, anything that made the conscious decision to lick me, I don't know. I can't eat it. So I can't see a dog stew in the 25th century. But that's what I'm saying. It's not the real thing. So could you do that? Or is there some kind of ethical problem of replicating Fido?
Well, I mean, even move away from the animal. It's just replicating human meat.
Oh, see, there you go.
Would you be able to do that? Is that right? I don't think it's right at all.
Well, you know, like Odo says, you know, murdering your own clone is still murder. So I guess if you make a clone just for of yourself, just, you know, to have something to eat, it'd still be murder. I don't know. But what about the replicator? I suppose it probably can. They have to have some kind of ethical sayings. So, no, Garfield is not going to be eaten today. Okay. Oh, and by the way, I looked it up. Thegatherers.com is taken, guys, so you could forget it. K campfires, Data. Seriously, are we back to that? I got to ask this question. Are we seriously back to season one, Data? You know, we have carbon dioxide and all the other things that he's describing as campfires. Is that not what I said? No, that's not what you said. Data knew what the composition of the campfire was, but couldn't say, I see several campfires.
Yeah. No, you're right. You're right to call it out as well. And this episode has another thing that's slightly related to the idea of infant Data syndrome, which is the Wunderkid Wesley syndrome as well. Mm-hmm. You know, that when the guy gets beamed aboard and he looks at Wesley, he goes, "A child, this isn't filling me with confidence." Again, you're calling out the fact that Wesley's a child and he's on the bridge and we all hate him. Mm-hmm. Why would you do this? Just treat him as normal. It's also not a particularly progressive thing to do, right? I mean, did any of the other aliens on Star Trek call out Uhura for being black or a woman? They didn't. It was taken for granted, and that was the message you're trying to put across. The serious message, which is that, you know, everyone is equal to their abilities, and you see past these things. Now, if you want to throw Wesley in as being some type of wonder kid, and we see past that, and if you want to put Data there as being an artificial life that we see past, you don't call them out every single episode. Yeah. And this is where I've just not quite, you know, it's a little bit clunky in that respect, a little bit of a throwback this year week.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Riker, Data, LaForge, and Worf beam down to check the area of the campfire. And they find a lot of stuff that was stolen by the gatherers, but they're nowhere to be seen until ambush. And the gatherers start firing on the way team, and not one of them has very good aim. So it looks like they're pinned down until Riker orders to, says, "Hey, why don't we melt that stuff over there?" And then say, "Enterprise, four to beam up." That was a pretty good ruse, wasn't it?
Oh yes, absolutely. In fact, I didn't see it coming, so it must have been. And then they disappear, and then they come back again. And perhaps your ambush would have been more successful if you bathed more often.
Yeah.
That he throws at the guys, which is completely true, right? You would. It's even mentioned later that Worf, when he goes out hunting, I think it's in Birthright, he would always be aware of the wind, so his scent isn't carried. It's a relatively sensible thing.
Yes.
So I like it.
That coming from the man who doesn't like a moonlight swim because it's too much like bathing. I highly doubt Worf bathes all that often. So, anyway. And later on DS9, O'Brien just messes with them, you know. Do I smell lilac?
Yes, indeed.
Earthy, peaty scent. Okay, whatever.
Isn't it Bashir that goes, I quite like how you smell, Commander?
Yeah. Also, anyway, okay, about that fake beam out. Do you believe that when he said four to beam up, they actually beamed them up and re-beamed them down? I just took it as once the smoke was rising, he didn't tap his communicator. They never went anywhere. They just happened to spread out and wait for them to come on down.
I thought they went up and down, but... But maybe there isn't. I thought there was a transporter trail, but maybe there wasn't.
I don't remember that. That's what I say. I just assume it was a fake beam out. Okay.
Oh, I've got it queued up on the side, so I'll be able to tell you in a second.
So now we get Maruk and Brühl meeting together. I kind of like the discussion with the two. You know, what is this for us in your society? You don't have to run anymore. You don't have to live out this life anymore. So, as a matter of fact, I'll just put I'm going to put audio from the Clan Wars right here. At the boom. That sounds right.
Now we're here to talk.
It's a waste of time, Captain. They don't care about how they live.
Am I supposed to believe that you care how we live?
Yes.
Brühl, she's here, isn't she?
Maybe you forced her to come, Picard.
Nobody forces me anywhere, Brule.
What is there for us on Akamar 3?
A life, a home. You can end your wanderings, your miserable existence.
Do I look miserable to you?
The clan wars are over, Brule. It is a past we're ashamed of. It is why you had to leave. Now, it is time to come home.
So I thought that the dialogue and the positions held by, you know, by both the gatherers and the Akamarians?
Yes, Akamarian.
I think they were very believable, and I thought that they were not just one-dimensional or caricatures. I think that, I mean, having said that, I think I didn't like the design of the gatherers. I think that the way that they were made up and they were kind of, you know, biker gang-ish made them a little bit, I thought they were stepping close to cliche. And some of the stuff that was written on them was a little bit close. But I thought when they ended up sitting down and actually negotiating, I thought their position was actually put across very well. And mm-hmm. certainly later on, when you start talking about, you know, there's, you know, people are, you're kind of throwing around a lot of relatively complicated ideas and words here for a you know, kids' TV show, if you want to call it that. Whether it's, you know, the amnesty that you're granting these people, whether, you know, talking about the what level of autonomy would the society be able to have. A lot of this stuff is, you know, is probably real stuff that you'd have to be dealing with in these mm-hmm. situations. And right, I actually thought it was handled in a pretty adult way.
Yeah, well, yeah, I agree. So now it's time for that tender moment between Brule, Picard, and Maruk. Everyone else, get out. Go do something, you know, take in the scenery, try the local cuisine, kill a former enemy clansman. Just go do something. Yeah. Again, what's happened? You know, we have to ask this question. Why is Troi not there? Because her antenna should have picked up that pending murder from the ship. You know, there's something going on down there. But, you know, Yuta goes to murder the really, really, really old gangster. Simply by touching him.
Yep, shortening his life by at least a week and a half.
Yes, at least. What was the deal with the funky eyepiece above his left eye? I kind of thought that looked like a Borg thing. Maybe if you check that out, I don't know if you noticed it before, but he's got some kind of circular eyepiece above his left eye.
Yeah, no, I do remember it. I always thought it was like night vision or something like that he was carrying around. Hmm. But I didn't necessarily take away that it was an implant, but yeah, they did have a very, well, very unique kind of style.
See, what Yuta should have done, instead of just touching him and killing him, let him take his little blue pill and have a little fun his last few minutes of life.
That's inappropriate. Also, here's the thing that I was a bit confused about. They mention, I mean, eventually they find out, right, that it's members of this clan that she's going off and trying to kill.
Yeah, Lornak.
Yeah, how many do you think she's killed? I mean, is she actually going after, you know, like hundreds or tens of thousands or how many are we talking about here? Because it seems to be that when the episode starts, there are only two of this clan left. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the episode, there's, you know, there's only one, or at least halfway through this episode, there's only one. And, you know, people didn't seem to be that concerned about that. And frankly, on the grounds that, you know, one of them is like 150 and the other one's a bloke that doesn't seem to have any kids. She doesn't really need to do anything. She could just retire now and outlive them without getting into any trouble. I think, you know, if you've managed to take a clan down to two males, you're pretty much done. I mean, within a generation or so, they're not gonna breed with each other and spawn children. So you're done. Take retirement early.
You know, another thing I'm curious about is 53 years before, she killed a man named Penthar Mol. So how does she know who all was in the Lornat clan? And what are we talking about when we say clan? Is it basically a family? They all have the same genetic structure as a family?
That's a valid question, and I don't think it's answered. But when you hear about the virus that has been genetically modified, you're given the impression that the way that she's killing them is through attacking something in their genetics, which kind of suggests it has to be a family, or at least a very much closely related race, for want of a better word. Which, if that's true, it's a bit strange that you went from a race that, or a clan that must have had lots of people in it, down to two, and no one seems to have noticed the imminent extinction of this clan.
Yeah, why couldn't they determine what happened to Penthor Mol 53 years ago? It just seemed that some bug got him and he's gone. But you're right, it never did get answered. Just how many people did she kill over her time? So an agreement is made, and Brule will come aboard the Enterprise alone and take him to Chorgon because, well, he's a better judge of these matters. And that's, of course, when they discover Volnoth. And then Crusher, well, obviously she can't save him, because, well, that's tradition. She can't save him. But she does figure out what killed him. Yeah, cardiac arrest, maybe? Oh, no, yeah, he died of a heart attack, but So what do you think about Maruk's description of how even the slightest attack on any clan member resulted in violent retaliation, and with each act of retribution, the violence would escalate? I thought that was pretty good, but then when Picard says, well, that's much like the history of our planet, okay. Well, I wasn't sure what he was talking about because I don't remember any clans wars going on here. But I do know, certain races were trying to extinct others.
I think it's over the top to suggest that there's a significant kind of parallel with humanity, I suppose, unless of course things are coming that are worse than I expect. And I do think that the way they explain it, right, it almost suggests that it would just escalate so quickly that it would be, you'd be forever, caught in these situations. Mm-hmm. So I was, and I think they might have over-egged it slightly on, just how, how much of a pushback you always got. So because, what one person happens to knock into someone else, running for the bus, and then the next minute, they come round and murder their cat, and the next minute you've got full-scale war kind of going on. So I always like to have things a little bit more ground in, not reality, of course, but in slightly less grand surroundings, I suppose.
Okay. Well, then I was thinking, I don't know what happens in London, but like I said in the past, we're almost getting nightly shootings here now. You should go to omaha.com and check it out. Right now, because the Huskers are playing today, that news is all about the Huskers. But if you go to, crimes and stuff, you see, Manhurt and Sunday altercation. Attorney sues to get bail for Omaha man facing murder charge. There's just... it's almost nightly. So, and what it is retaliation. And a lot of it is you shoot this guy, no one's going to talk. No one's going to tell the police what happened. What they're going to do is go out and retaliate. And then their family retaliates or their gang retaliates. And so that's what's going on here. But Brule strolls on to 10-4 just to be a complete ass. And actually, I found that amusing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's slightly, encroaching on Riker's territory. But I thought it was quite good.
Yeah, he takes a man's drink, grabs Wesley's homework, and then sets him straight about assuming that he's just being an ass. So I thought the Wesley-Brule exchange was pretty good, too. You could see Wesley going from almost pure hatred to laughing because this guy's actually... not what he really thought he was. Does that make sense, or did you detect that, Ernie?
I think, I think it's a, I think there's, of course, there's an exterior that this guy carries that is not quite what, you know, the reality of the situation is. So I think it's good when, you know, as soon as I think Wesley find out that he has kids and one of them the same age and he's trying to actually do something better, that I think, you know, Wesley starts to give him a bit of a benefit of doubt. And it's not, he doesn't just come across as a, you know, a scary kind of a, you know, a scary nomad or whatever.
Okay. But also in the same room, we have Maruk and Yuta. And Riker comes strolling on in, and Yuta says, "Would you please excuse me, because he would like me to make him something to eat." And she does. She makes him something to eat. And him and Deanna like it. So Deanna takes off. She sits down, and he continues. But then what's weird is as they're talking, Maruk calls, "Yuta, can't you give the woman 5 minutes alone?" Because all she did was she just walked back over and stood there. I don't know. Maybe she was hungry.
You're right. You're right. It was like, do you mind if I go over here? Oh, no, sure. Knock yourself out. And then almost immediately, hey, you're coming back. That's enough. Enough fun for one day.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. Maybe she's hungry. You know, she's a big girl. Maruk is a big girl. Maybe she eats a lot. That's why she has to have her servant do make her dinners all the time.
So the suggestion that the sovereign doesn't usually have her chef come, but this particular sovereign does.
Oh, I bet this. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, usually the chef stays home because there's a lot of servants to feed. You know, who's feeding the rest of the servants back at home? But anyway, Maruk, I think you know, if she eats a lot, she reminds me of Howard Wolowitz's mother. Howard! Anyway, if you haven't seen Big Bang Theory, it went over your head. But you have. I know you have.
I have seen an episode of Big Bang Theory, but I didn't. That did go over my head. And by the way, Lou, I am a little bit disappointed that I didn't get called out onto contravariant Riemann tensor stuff that Wesley was working on.
Oh, that's right. What was he working on? I don't know. Was it something faring on the kind of like cave manifold, or I don't remember what it was. What was it?
I think it was something like the local Euclidenization of some, I think it's a cave fold. It was a cave fold. I think it was a Riemann tensor field, I believe.
You know, Data Logan's yelling at us right now.
But the, should I call the... Wesley probably isn't working on that, by the way, just because that's actually pretty advanced stuff. Now, I think that, you know, most of the stuff that they talk about is real, although Wesley does mispronounce Riemann. but there we are. But most of the stuff that he's talking about there, as far as I can work on, I think the only time that... I think the only time that most people end up studying any stuff on, you know, tensor fields is in general relativity. I'm sure there are other applications, but that's probably the main big guy. So he's probably doing some general relativity. But he's only 16. I don't think you should be doing general relativity until you're like 22. But maybe I'm wrong. Yes. Or maybe people have become a lot more advanced in the 24th century.
Yeah, but that's today. Like you said a week or two ago, you know, they do calculus in kindergarten now. But here, I'm actually playing it. I'm going to try and re-speak what he says if I can. Let's see. He's walking up to him. He's... What are you doing? Homework.
That's the answer. Math.
Homework. Yeah, but hold on. Local Euclidean metrization of a K-fold contravariant what the hell?
He says Riemann tensor field at the end. Well, he's supposed to say Riemann. He says Riemann.
Tensor fuel.
Tensor.
What are you doing?
Homework.
What is this?
Math.
I can see that, but what does it mean?
This is the locally Euclidean metrization of a K-fold contravariant Riemann tensor field.
You any good at it? You don't like me. I didn't say that. No problem. I have many friends that don't like me. But what do you know about me? You're a thief. I steal to survive, not because I enjoy it. We gatherers value our freedom. We do what we want, and we answer to no creature.
Then why are you helping Sovereign Maruk to change all that?
Maybe because I want something better for me and for my children.
You have children?
Yeah, two sons. One's just about your age. He's not any good at math.
Yeah, you any good at it? But you know what's interesting also is that Maruk and Picard are in 10-4 as well. But for some reason, Brühl jumps up at Wesley and screams at him, but doesn't attract anyone's attention.
Yeah, I think that's okay. Like they're just sitting there. That, you know, they know when they're going to get involved. They're not going to get involved just after, you know, the fatal blow has been delivered.
Take Wesley out, and then we'll stop him. Okay. Well, now we find Crusher calling Riker to sick babe, so he doesn't even get to finish his Porthos. Okay, Parthos. It seems Volnoth was affected by the virus that would strike 1 in 1,000,000 Akamarians, so let's call CSI. He was murdered. But, okay, here's another thing. That's Maruk. I guess she must be full by the end of the night, because she has no need for her UTA services anymore and suggests that she go visit Riker in his quarters. And I thought it was funny when Riker is sitting there like, God, this day sucked, you know, and he snaps at Data on the comm system because he's just having a rough day. And then she, come in.
He's just about to check the holodeck schedule for the afternoon. Mm-hmm. To see if he can slip any time in, and, you know, who comes along and knocks on the door.
Yes. So he goes either from Jekyll to Hyde or Hyde to Jekyll. I'm not sure who was a bad one, who was a good one. But either way, he goes there. His bipolar comes up. As soon as she walks in the door, he's like, hello. How are you today? Maruk said, what? Oh, she's so sweet.
Well, now, listen, when, you know, when I get to be sovereign, okay, and have some of, you know, these servants, I'm not going to let my servant go off and, you know, bang Riker just because, you know, she happens to think it's a good idea for that day. That's not, you know, why would you let her do that? She's supposed to be at work, and she's supposed to be, you know, this is a diplomatic mission. So I don't understand why, you know, the idea of the sovereign saying, yes, please, child, go up and do your thing. No, I'm not buying it.
Oh, James,
I think she must have slipped out. She must have escaped without anyone noticing. Gone.
Do you even realize how much I've changed you in the last year and a half? No. At the beginning of this series, James would have never said, go off and bang Riker. So, what have I done to you? and you, the blow me part from 2 weeks ago. What have I done to you, you poor man? Does your wife get angry? Who are you? It's that fat bastard in Omaha that's done it to me.
No, I think I'm. It's really unfortunate. I think I'm coming round to the idea that I don't particularly like Riker at the moment.
Yeah.
I don't like him any as much as I seem to remember liking him. And worst of all, we've got a couple of episodes up that are pretty poor Riker episodes. We have a Matter of Perspective coming soon, and I think that one's horrendous for Riker, because he basically, you know, that's the one where he turns up and says, yep, might have killed a guy, but what are you going to do about it? And he becomes the most, he refuses to engage or acknowledge anything whilst everyone reckons he's a murderer. And it's like, well, you know, I actually think I might not like Riker anymore.
Mm. Yeah, and they reuse that same trope when in the Dax episode when she refuses to talk about it, Benjamin. I'm not talking to talk about it. Oh, man, they're going to take you. Okay, just chill. Let it go. Let it go. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. Riker was very enigmatic in that episode, but it'll come up. I don't know. I like the episode. I like the episode, but you're right. Riker is just like sitting back, letting it all happen. So they're lucky that. Wait a minute. Who was it that saved the day? Was it Wesley or was it Geordi this time? Or Data? We'll get to there later.
I think it's Data and Geordi. I think they come up with a tech reason why the dude would have shot himself after it been reflected from the transporter beam. Spoilers.
Yeah, right. Spoilers. If you haven't seen it yet. Sorry.
Actually, let me just come back to Vengeance Factor here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so I mentioned a couple of weeks ago that I don't remember how this episode ended. I didn't remember I'm going to call it the subplot or the plot line with Yuta touching people and making them die. Mm-hmm. I actually didn't remember that. And when I rewatched, when they re-released the Blu-rays a couple of years ago, and it was probably the first time in 10 years that I saw the episode, I was actually pleasantly surprised that this was relatively a new trek that I had forgotten. And I think one of the reasons is that what I always take away from this episode is the story about the gatherers and them being brought back in and the negotiations and stuff, and almost this Yuta kind of like separate thread is kind of like a bit of standalone. And I just remember, I remember forgetting about that part of the show. And, you almost, it's a representation that you don't actually need to have that part of the story. You could have just had a relatively plain vanilla story about people reaching a compromise on their, from a peace treaty perspective. You didn't need this thread. And I just thought that was interesting. So I think that I like the thread. I think the thread makes the episode more interesting and more developed. Even though I don't like Riker, but I just remember having the joy of rewatching this without knowing what the twist was.
Hmm. Okay. So then, on the Blu-ray version, does she look any better when she's vaporizing?
I don't think she's. No. Not really.
Okay. All right.
But
well,
let me know when we get to the vaporizing, because I've got a lot of stuff to say about the vaporizing.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, we'll get there. Yeah. But anyway, we're still in Riker's quarters as he's holding on to Yuta's face, and then all of a sudden, boom, red alert. And he has to leave, unfortunately, because Chorgon's firing on the Enterprise. Do you think maybe Chorgon's ship was pretty much another glob fly?
Yeah, I think that's the impression you're given. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, because they took out his shield in one shot. But of course, they waited a while. I mean, everybody had to bounce around on the ship for a while.
I mean, think how inconvenient it is for people that are sleeping at that point. They'd probably be knocked out of bed just because Picard won't, he won't open fire particularly fast.
Right. Yeah, let's just hold off. Picard beams over with Brule and Maruk to discuss the situation. And again, Troy stayed behind. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk about this. Chorgon wants autonomy. And of course, she said there's several levels of autonomy. I kind of get the idea of autonomy. You're on your own. You're your own being, or your group is your own group, not subjected to the rules of other groups, right?
Okay, sure.
Okay. She said his region would have certain rights, because they set aside some land. why don't we go for broke and call it a reservation instead of set aside some land? You could build your own casinos on your own reservation.
Oh, but do you think that's what they were going for?
That's what it seemed like. You have this party planned.
I hear you now. And I mean, obviously, calling it reservation is, you know, completely opens up a different imagery. But actually, I didn't see. You know, that's not where I was heading.
Really? Because my question is, when they get on this land, are they allowed to go to other lands? Are you going to go to their land? You've got this corner. You can do what you want. Farm if you want, or don't farm. Who the hell cares? I don't. And that's when he says, well, you know, we want 3 seats on the ruling council. But what confused me is that, you know, she screams, 3 seats! No one has that! And then Picard says, well, you know, if the positions were reversed, you would be wanting equal levels of representation. So which is it? No one has that? Or 3 seats would be equal representation? That was kind of confusing.
Oh, when Picard says equal, I thought that he meant equal to, that she would be proposing the same thing that he was proposing in this opposite situation. So I think that Picard was just saying that if Maruk was in that position, she would be demanding 3 seats. Yeah, so I got the impression that the ruling council was, I don't know, say 20 or so, and 3 was a significant chunk, but wouldn't in any way like form a majority. So it was a significant chunk, possibly over-representation for the number of people that we're talking about. Mm. So, you know, more bang for your buck. I suppose in the same way that, I suppose in the US, right, you guys, you still have the situation where you have 2 senators per state. Mm-hmm. So if you go to a small state, you've effectively still got the same representation as if you go to a larger state, in a Senate at least. I thought that all they were doing, they were just like overweighing their representation rather than anything else.
Yeah, but you still got this, you know, number of votes that you have to have. And so I guess only 3 seats on, it depends what the ruling council is. If it's a, you know, 6 member ruling council, well, then they're way too much. But, and then it's, you know, what does the ruling council include? Different plots of land, different groups? Like you say, with the Senate, it's pretty much what it is there.
So, you're not told. I was given the impression, certainly by the reaction, that this was like the highest authority.
Yes.
So this would be, you know, this would be the top tier, whether it be the equivalent of the Senate I suppose in the US it would be the Senate or, you know, into the Houses of Parliament in the UK.
But why was she so stunned by it? I mean, was she expecting them to just take this plot of land, be under her rule, but yet they have no say in this? You know what it had been like later on down the road when they tried to start asserting their own individual freedoms and it goes against the will of the state?
Well, I think that all that she was saying, I think, you know, they were pushing for kind of like, you know, over-representation with respect to their population. And I think that she was probably pushing back on it being, you know, too overly representative. So, I mean, we have a situation, well, lots of countries have different situations where, you know, certain areas will get effectively more bang for your buck when you consider the population. So if you think the gatherers are like 10,000 people, you know, that going to come in, they're going to have specific needs to them, but they're probably joining, you know, 10 million people. And then the question becomes, you know, is it fair to give them only, you know, 1/1000th of the vote? Well, it probably isn't, because they're going to get drowned out. They are specific people with specific needs. And if they were to join the, you know, the mass populace, their voice would just be completely removed. So I thought they were just talking about the way that they would go about ensuring that the gatherers would not be, you know, would not be just ignored and lost.
Okay.
And the issue of the autonomy, I mean, I think that they were really just coming down to the idea of, okay, you know, what are you allowed to do? What decisions are you allowed to take in your own land? Because I didn't think that they were talking about total autonomy, so like a completely independent state or anything like that. I think they were talking about there are certain things that would be, that you'd be allowed to decide, you'd be allowed to run, and then there would be other things that would be, you know, as part of the grander state or the grander government.
Mm.
Okay. Actually, which is why when I was talking relatively, you know, a while ago, I suppose now, you know, I do think they throw around a lot of these words and a lot of these discussions that, to me, make kind of perfect sense, but they don't kind of go into it and have to spell it out for, you know, all of the people watching. And I quite like the way that it's handled in a, you know, in an adult and a relatively realistic way.
Hmm.
You know, without putting too much, they didn't have to put any exposition about this. They didn't have to say, well, you're asking for 3 seats, but we know there are only 50 seats. And if we gave 3 seats to you, then there'll be other problems. You know, it's just put out there in a very realistic way, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I got a feeling they still wouldn't have been happy because they're probably still going to get shot down each time. Okay. So 53 years ago, a man named Penther Mole was killed by the same microvirus. And during the same investigation, it was determined Penther Mole was also from the Lornat clan, same as Volnoth. And guess what? So is Trorgon. And so they pull up. How does Data find this picture of Penther Mole 53 years ago and finds the girl behind him? And she hasn't aged a day. Isn't that amazing? There had to, unless that was the only picture they had of Penther Mole, of him being led to his trial, and she's sitting behind him, or standing behind him, I guess. That's a pretty slim margins there, isn't it?
Yeah, Data's fast. He can go through lots of pictures very quickly, and
that's true.
I suppose find them.
Yeah.
I think that. I actually, my heart sank a little bit when I saw the idea of there, you know, there's a partial face, and are you able to reconstruct it? Because some of the stuff they do, and they've been doing it more and more and more, the way that they try to reconstruct small pieces of Data, and they extrapolate, and they come up with like a perfect match, or, you know, they enhance, and Star Trek does this a lot as well, right? They say, well, enhance the picture, and it kind of gets better. I think I'm going to give them a pass on this one because I think it was okay. I think there was enough there. And by the time you had removed the foreground, I think you could kind of tell who it was anyway. So I think it's more of a bin, you know, you don't catch it because you're looking at the picture and you have it. You have a lot of other stuff distracting you rather than it just being a single dot that they, you know, they enhance and they rotate and they enhance again.
Mm. No, I mean, they enhance. I'd say about 80 to 90% of the image. I mean, 80 to 90% of her body is missing, but somehow they enhance it even with the nice flowing hair. How could they possibly do that?
I think there's around 40% of the face, right? That's there or not? I thought there were around 40% of the
face.
Yeah,
it could have been, yes.
But and most faces are symmetric. But I agree. The idea of, you know, catching, you know, this woman happens to be carrying a particularly, you know, lopsided hairstyle that they managed to get accurately is obviously not true. Like, they wouldn't be able to do things like that.
Yeah.
And did anyone not think, when they say 53 years and she hasn't aged a day, could they not have just said, oh, maybe it's her grandmother then?
Yeah, right. Or her mother. Yeah, I guess it could. But she hasn't aged a day. Well, I guess they figured out what clan everybody was from. They had to get something from. But they figured out it was her, so Riker beams down. Okay, so we get to the part. Now, was it really necessary to keep stunning her and vaporize her? And it's like he stood 10 feet away. We know she can only kill Trorgon. She can't kill anybody else in the room by doing anything. So why doesn't he just walk up and grab her by the neck and pinch her out for a while? Why did he have to keep stunning her and then vaporize her?
I don't know. I think it's one of the most ridiculous things. This last scene is just even before we get to this, right, we get the point where, you know, there's tense negotiations going on. I think, you know, very believable. Riker beams in, and the first thing he does, he takes out one of the security guards that's attached to the gatherers, and I don't know if he kills him or not, but everyone seems to be very calm that has just happened. It's like, Picard ends up saying things like, oh, I'm sure my first officer has a good reason for having shot your guy down.
Ooh.
Riker, you have a good reason, right? Yeah, sure.
Sure I do.
I thought that he would at least be put in prison for doing that, if not shot on the spot. So that was the first thing that was a bit weird. And then you get onto this issue about the phaser. And so, you know, Riker could have done a lot. He could have stopped her by just walking over. But instead, he phases her and then has the phaser on a higher setting. And then thinks, well, if this setting that only pushes you back slightly doesn't work, then I'm going to have to use a vaporizer. Is there no middle ground in there? I mean, it's like, it's ridiculous. It's like, you know, it's like asking the guy in front of you, you know, let's say you come up to, you're in a car, you come up to the lights, there's a guy in front, you know, he doesn't happen to move fast enough, so you beep him, he doesn't move again. What are you going to do? You're going to vaporize him?
Vaporize him.
It seems to be that there's something missing on this scale here.
Yeah.
If nothing else, you know, beep again. Beep a third time.
But be careful, he'll try and vaporize you. Yeah, okay. Man, I'm sorry, guys. I'm going to apologize for our call reception. But, yeah, your voice, when you rehear this episode again later, James, you're going to find that, oh, my goodness. It sounded like we should get some tin cans and string across a couple thousand miles in, and it might work better. It's really terrible.
Is that not what we're doing?
I think so. And, you know, when Skype asked me, how was your call this time? I'm going to answer it. I'm going to have to answer it. Okay, so he stops Utah by giving her the vaporized treatment.
Yeah, and I have to say that the people sitting behind Utah are really praying that Riker's got a good aim on this third shot.
Mm.
You know, they don't want her to duck and to be unfortunately hit. And another thing, right? If you're going to... So I'm sorry to go on about the vaporize thing because I do find it so funny. In order to vaporize someone, you have to deliver enough energy into their little body thing until they actually just turn into, you know, effectively just, you know, turn into vapor. They get transformed from their solid state. The entirety of their body gets turned into, you know, some type of gas that just vaporizes off. You have to be pretty accurate in terms of, you know, how much energy that's going to cost. So anyone has, you know, if you get hit with enough energy, you will be boiled alive and eventually you'll be vaporized. That is what's going to happen.
Mm.
The way they do it on Star Trek is that the energy that is being sent over in the beam is absolutely just enough to vaporize the person in front of you in a homogeneous way, which again is a little bit weird that it shouldn't really be like that, but it completely vaporizes the person and there's nothing left so that any beam continues on and knocks the person out behind them. So how can it be that you just deliver just enough energy and no more? So to me, I would think a more realistic thing is that the guy gets half vaporized until there's a hole in him and then he manages to shoot Picard sitting behind her.
Mm-hmm.
That would generally be what would happen if you tried to put enough energy through a phaser beam in, you know, when someone's standing between you and there. You know, certainly long before the woman's feet vaporize, this person's going to have a hole in her and he's going to be, you know, he's going to be hurting people around. Anyway, that's too morbid. I do apologize.
No problem. Where's her clothes?
Well, the clothes also got vaporized.
Right. Should they have been?
Well, you can vaporize clothes if you put enough energy into an energy beam to vaporize clothes. But, but you know, the difference in energy needed to vaporize you if you're wearing jeans versus if you're wearing, you know, other trousers is probably, a fair bit. So I don't understand how the phase is so accurate that you can exactly vaporize the one person and all his clothes and anything he happens to have in his wallet and, you know, any jewelry that they have exactly and not have any overspill to the people around them. To me, it makes no sense. And of course, vaporizing enough means that you're turning the person into a horrendous, kind of extremely hot vapor. Mm. You would probably not want to breathe that in.
Oh, I suppose not. Plus,
or be in the same room as it. It's probably going to stink.
Well, yeah, probably. Plus, I can't imagine vaporizing somebody in, 0.2 seconds. I would imagine that takes a little bit of time and a lot of pain. Now, what would happen if she was holding somebody's hand at the time he vaporized her? Do they get it too? Because it goes through the hand?
Well, I suppose it only would if the hand happened to be a good conductor. But actually, the thing about the human body is that, in general, you're not a good conductor. Which means, if you did get shot with a giant laser on the arm, you would probably have localized pain on the arm, and you might even be able to shoot an arm off without your foot really realizing it.
Mm.
So, unfortunately, in the end, I'm just coming round to this idea that I don't believe in the vaporizing within Star Trek in general.
Hmm.
I think it's a very clean way to get bodies off screen.
Right, right.
And that's really all.
That's true. Okay, Chorgon thanks Riker for saving him. Riker just shrugs it off. But I think there's a missed opportunity. Riker should have said something like, well, then why don't you sit down, shut up, and listen to what these two are trying to tell you? And then he could walk away. But instead, he goes back to the ship, sits in 10 forward, and spins his drink around.
Hmm? Yeah, it's a bit of a sad end in a way, right, for Riker?
Well,
because he was, so close to finding true happiness.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he could have saved her, but again, step in front of her, but she had already killed one gatherer, so I guess either way, she was going for murder. Perhaps. Depends on what their laws are. But anyway, so Captain Picard comes into 10 forward and says, we're going to Starbase 343 for medical supplies, but hey, it's pretty cool down there. I think I'll let anybody who wants to go do some shore leave. Hint, hint. You want to go, number one? Yeah, I'll pass that along to the crew. So we got to find out what Starbase 343 is. Why would somebody want to take shore leave on a starbase?
I mean, Starbase could be on a planet, I suppose.
That's true. Well, no.
But I always get the impression when you talk about the starbases, in my mind, it's pretty unfair. I always consider them to be a bit like a... Now, you must have, in the US, you must have service stations in the same way that we do in the UK. So when you go on a long-distance motorway journey, mm-hmm. you end up having to freeway. You end up having to stop over for petrol or gas, I suppose, as you call it. I just consider these star bases to be not much more than these generic service stations that will sell you a coffee for about £4 and, some crisps that have gone off. The idea of having shore leave at one of these star bases whilst you're there is, I think, the 24th century equivalent of going for a wander around a service station as you're on a long journey. So not particularly appealing.
Or a rest area. We have rest areas here. Some of them have vending machines and maps and stuff. You can see where you're going. Other rest areas, you just pull over, stop, walk around the car for a couple minutes, and then continue on.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Yeah.
Okay.
Shore leave. So next time you're driving, if you're driving your wife and daughter all around, tell them that if you do stop off at a rest area, say, I think that we can have shore leave here.
What? Yeah, really. What have what? Yeah, let's do some shore leave. Yes, here at the Starbase.
Yeah. The captain is authorizing shore leave for anyone who wants it, and then look around the car and see if anyone notices.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, right then, I guess this is it, bringing us to the end. We got Fur Bob coming on in a little bit, so do we have anything else to talk about?
Nope, I don't think so.
Okay, then. Well, then I'd say it's time for our final thoughts and ratings in this episode, and our scale of 1 to 5, with 1 being terrible and 1 being the good stuff, the stuff that everybody wants to snort.
Did you say 1 being terrible and 1 being the good stuff as well?
No, 5. I said that, then 5's a good stuff. 5's like the powder cocaine that everybody wants, I guess. Except for me. And you, I'm sure.
Shall we put a disclaimer to suggest that we do not endorse the use of cocaine?
Yeah, absolutely. We do not.
The FDA in the US and the MHRA in the UK has determined that continued listening and partaking in the Battlebridge podcast could be detrimental to your health. The use of the aforementioned narcotic is not recommended by anyone on the Battlebridge podcast or its parent podcast, Blue Trek Show, the Trekmate family, even if it's being consumed by some of its listeners, Tech Podcast Network, God, or even the planet Earth. All rumblings are those of the host and do not represent anyone not currently stoned at this time. All offers with approved credit, mileage rate varies, and the use of petrol, gasoline, or E85 is at the sole discretion of the driver of the vehicle. Potential side effects of this show include yawning, sleepiness, or anger, ranging from mild annoyance to episodes of sub-psychotic rage. Other side effects include itching, sneezing, coughing, coma, or even death. Consult a doctor before listening to this garbage. Never consume raw meats, as it could be a health hazard. Not recommended for listening by newborns, infants, or toddlers under the age of 18 years old. Listener discretion advised.
In fact, you really should not. But anyway. So my final thoughts and ratings are, I kind of like this episode. I feel Riker's pain in the end. I do. I don't like him coming on to her instantly because, number one, he didn't get medical clearance. so he shouldn't have done that. But anyway, you know, but in the end, he wasn't simply trying to de-pants someone. He was trying to help her through her pain. I think three phaser shots may not have been needed. All he had to do was stand between him and Chorgana and just tackle her. He got close to her. He wanted to get that close to her anyway. You know, she couldn't hurt anyone except the Lornet clan. I think that's interesting that they came up with that. Let's see here. It reminds me of the TOS episode where these lovelies kept appearing on the ship to kill somebody, and, you know, I've come for Spock, and everybody else gets to protect Spock because she could touch all the other guys all she wants, but when she touches the guy, he dies. Remember that episode?
Do you know, if you have to ask me anything more about it, I wouldn't be able to tell you. Mm. It's I know it's there. I can't remember. Where did that come from?
I can't remember, but I do not know, really. I don't know TOS names. I really don't, except for a couple, a few here and there. But yeah, I don't have a clue. But yeah, they pretty much, yeah, you know, they were pretty haughty. But when they touch you, oh boy. Okay, so anyway, Marina Sirtis, she got a great paycheck. In fact, she probably should have given a refund check for her performance this week. Her main role is to sit on the bridge, make faces, and then tell how the Parthos tasted, and then excuse herself. That was her job for the week. I want to be an actor. For some reason, I like the Gatherers. If it weren't for the raids they do, I could imagine the lifestyle of being free. I feel there is a political lesson in play here. Quite honestly, I'm not exactly sure what it is. I, you know, as far as there has to be some kind of political message. Bring the group back to the planet. Let them roam on the reservation, but don't allow the Manny representation to help decide policy. Not right. I would never accept it. So anyway, I wish we could have revisited this story a couple years from now and see how the Gallers acclimated to life on Akamar. So I would have liked to have seen what they had done. Would they have caused trouble in the beginning? And now, you know, they have, they even have one of their own major cities somewhere broke off from the group. Not sure. In the end, I can't give it a 5, but I'm not so sure a 3 is really appropriate. I do like this one. This is going to sound strange, but I'm leaning between 3.5 and a 4. And I'm probably going to, as we talked, I was going to do a 4, but I think I'm actually going to go 3.5. So, what about the No Half Doctor? What do you think?
Yeah. Okay, do you know, I do think it is somewhere between a 3 and a 4. That is correct. I like this episode as well. I think I've mentioned, you know, throughout the last hour or so, all of the stuff that I do enjoy. And I do like the story that it's trying to tell. I do think that the story is a little bit larger than it's able to, you know, to pull off in the end. I think that the it's not a perfect delivery of this particular, you know, this particular story, this political, like, you know, political philosophy of the week kind of thing, which is why I think, in a certain extent, I think, Lou, you find it difficult to exactly understand what that, you know, where that coming from and what they want to say in the story. It's more of a mishmash of stuff that just happens to, you know, happens to be part of the plot, rather than an overarching story that has a specific, you know, philosophical or even it has a specific analogy in today's world. But I do think it's a nice story. It's a nice attempt. I actually like the idea of Utah being around and kind of adding a little bit of mystery behind the scenes. I really don't like Riker hitting on her. I just always think it's very, very clunky. And I think I'm going to have to knock off at least, you know, 0.39 of a point for that. I do remember this one quite well because this one happens to be... I've mentioned before that I used to watch... Trek on VHS, and the VHS came in packs of two episodes, at least in the UK they did. And this one is backed with The Defector that is coming up next week, and as a result, this particular, you know, this particular tape got a lot of watch. So maybe there's a bit of me that likes it a lot because of it being attached to the Defector disc or the Defector tape. Now, overall, I don't think it's, you know, I think it's a little bit clunky in terms of how our characters get into this story. But overall, I think it's a, you know, a good, solid episode of Trek. And I actually think that I'd be interested to hear what other people think, because, Lou, I'm surprised you came in so positive. I think that this episode's considered to be a bit of a stinker by the, you know, community at large. So I was going to be coming in at a 3 this week, but I thought I was going high with a 3 for this, you know, at least compared to what other people would think. So it would be good to know what other people, you know, how they saw this episode and what they felt. So a 3 from me, though.
Okay, and when he says he's interested in what other people think, Ben, that doesn't mean you. We already know. But I'd like to see you pour reasons for a 5 out of this. That'd be fun to hear. Or see, or read, or whatever. Okay, then. Great.
Next time on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Please, you must help me!
An archenemy defects to the Enterprise.
You're a traitor!
I came to stop a war.
But can he save them from a death trap?
You're a spy, aren't you?
Or will he lure them into a full-scale massacre?
Shall we die together?
Find out on Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Well, all right. I suppose now just time to mention that you should join us again next week as we review episode 10 of series 3, which is The Defector. And that's a great episode.
All right.
Spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
So and I believe we're going to have a Furbob on for that.
I'll yes. Yes, we are. We are. It's been confirmed, hopefully. I don't see him online just yet, but hopefully we will.
Don't let people on the magic of the recording schedule. Oh. Although actually, it's already online, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Never mind, I didn't mean that, guys. I meant when we talk next week. No, I'm kidding. Of course, we do these two at a time. Because okay, then well, I get to do the Defector! Sorry.
Okay, well, just, you know, I'm James from London.
And I'm Lou from Nebraska.
And good night, everybody.
Good night. All right, so let's go ahead and we're going to do some forum feedback. And I believe we left off with The Bonding, episode 5. And it starts off with me saying, just wanted to beat Karen, who you will hear on the next week's show. And, of course, he was on the next week's show, which was...
So Booby Trap.
Booby Trap. All right, then. Yeah, we all give it 3s. I like that. So anyway, Kieran came on again and said, like James, I don't remember liking this episode much either. I always felt like it dragged quite a bit. Having listened to the podcast, I think you guys managed to figure out why. Mind you, they seem to have a few episodes like this at the start of season 3 where there's not much action and it's almost all driven by the characters themselves. That's fine, but it would have been nice to mix it up a bit. In this case, the action takes place just before the episode begins. First, let's address the whole kids on a starship issue. This is something that never really made sense to me. You wouldn't do that in the military now, would you? You might have your family living on the base with you, but if you were always on tour, whether the tour be a six-month tour of Afghanistan or a five-year mission exploring the unknown sectors of space, I wouldn't have thought you'd take your family with you for safety reasons. It's dangerous out there. So the Enterprise-D having families on board, like some kind of cruiser liner, while simultaneously being the flagship of the Starfleet, they would ascend to places like the neutral zone when things get heated, is utterly ridiculous. But, and this is a good but, wasn't the original plan for TNG that they ditch the saucer section anytime this kind of thing happened? That would have at least made some sense, but that plan was shelved because it cost too much to produce the episodes and to do the saucer section and decant to the battle bridge every time something happened. What is decant? Never heard of that.
Leave. I would use leave. With leave.
Okay. Yeah, I knew there were, that's where he's headed. I just never heard of the word decant. Which is a shame because the battle bridge was criminally underused throughout the series. And that's why we are called the battle bridge. We're criminally underused. I'm still not convinced the unknown wouldn't be an issue. You can't separate the saucer if Q suddenly appears on board and whacks you 7,000 light years, for instance. So it would still be too dangerous for families, in my opinion. So I think they made a rod for their own back with families on a starship. However, regardless of whether Jeremy is on the ship or not, his mother would still have been killed, and we would still have to deal with these issues brought up in this episode somewhere along the line. My favorite part of this episode is how they used Wesley. Him being angry at Picard was some terrific writing and a great way to show Jeremy how other people deal with it. Wesley's learned to deal over the years, but that doesn't mean his anger isn't still there. It's a difficult storyline, but it's really well done, and it's nice to see Star Trek not ducking it as if they would some other issues. I think using Wesley worked out a lot better than Jeremy trying to bond with Worf over his parental loss. Yes, Worf lost both parents as a kid, whereas Wesley only lost his father. But Jeremy can relate to Wesley far more due to the similar age gap. But possibly more important is the fact that Worf is technically the bad guy in Jeremy's mind. Would Wesley have tried to bond with Picard at the time of Jack Crusher's death? I doubt it. I agree. Furthermore, I don't really understand the Klingon ritual part. It seemed like a needless aspect of the story. It wasn't the only one, though. The whole ghost mom thing seemed superfluous to me. I think you need these aspects to pad out of the episode and get up to the 40 to 45 minute mark. But to be honest, I found them mostly to be a filler. I like the idea of having suffered the loss. You would cling to the idea of someone giving you them back. But the whole alien being feeling guilty about it and wanting to interfere just doesn't hold my interest. It's almost like they had some kind of geeky sci-fi aspect of the episode just to keep us interested, whereas the human aspect of the episode is where it really shines. It's not that I didn't like it, as James mentioned in closing, I just don't think they did anything with it, and I'm really not sure they needed it for storytelling to be a strong one. Another bit I really enjoyed in this episode was a conversation between Data and Riker, where we use Data to examine human nature. I like Riker's line about how he reckons human history would have been a lot less bloody if we cared about about all deaths, as much as we care about the death of that we know. I often moan about how deaths on the news are always treated as more important if people were from your own country were killed. For instance, there's a terrorist attack where 100 people are killed. That's obviously considered bad, but it's even one of those. But if even one of those is British, it becomes full on meltdown. Really? Is that true?
I mean, yes, that is true here, but also that's true in the US as well, right? That's very true in the US. I notice it there as well.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah. That always annoys me. That's true. So if an American gets killed off in England, yeah, that is a problem, and it does make news, you're right. That always annoys me, even though I know exactly why it happens. As far as Marla being killed in an honorable way. I think she just died in the line of duty. I don't think she dived on the bomb, and I agree with Lou that I think she just got caught in the blast as the one at the end of the line. She took the brunt of it, which indirectly saved everyone else. Nothing more, but she was on duty at the time, so it is an honorable way to go in the eyes of the Klingon. To answer the question that Lou brought up, no, I don't have a persona of Kieran McDuff. At least I hope I don't. It was a nice Scottish-sounding name from an episode of Star Trek that I love. Admittedly, he was a guy who probably wasn't actually called Kieran McDuff. So we don't have that much in common. I'm merely masquerading as Kieran. I'm pretty sure that's where the likeness ends, though. My overall score for this episode would probably be a 3 out of 5. There's some really strong points in the episode and some terrific writing at times, but I think it's let down quite badly by having too much padding. One of those episodes where there's maybe not enough to make a full episode out of a really good idea, and it suffers for that reason. It's a shame because the good in it is terrific. Oh, thank you, Kieran. He's very thorough, isn't he?
Indeed. Yes. Or at least he writes a lot on forums.
He does. Yes, he does. Okay, so, yeah, third week in a row.
Okay, excellent. So we've actually got another post from Endicore, who has only been recently posting, I think, for the last couple of weeks.
I meant third week in a row.
Oh, okay. Sorry. That went right over my head. So thank you once again for that. So he strokes she, because we don't know yet. Starts with, about the most noteworthy thing about this rather forgettable episode is that it was Roland D. Moore's first writing credit. The first half is definitely solid, and the writers even acknowledge how stupid it is to have children on the Enterprise. However, I don't think there's quite enough material here to fill 40 minutes. Looking at Memory Alpha, it reads like young Jeremy was supposed to recreate his family on the holodeck with no aliens being involved. But then the episode would have ended 15 minutes too early, as Jean-Luc Picard, captain of the Federation flagship, seasoned diplomat and brilliant tactician, confronts a 12-year-old boy, revokes his holodeck privileges, and sends him to Troy's office. A satisfying climax that is not. The overprotective aliens needed to be there as antagonists worthy enough of listening to Picard's speeches, but that shifted the episode away from the main issue of dealing with loss and turned it into a bizarre custody battle. I enjoy this episode more watching it now than when I was too young to understand its themes, but the story might have worked better as a B-plot to another episode, so it gets a 3 out of 5 from me as well. By the way, did I give it a 3 out of 5? I actually cannot remember. But
Let me look.
But I have to say, I think comments so far have been pretty, I kind of agree with. So in the back of my mind, I must have given it a 3 out of 5.
Yeah, you did. I gave it a 3 as well, and Brian gave it a 4.
So one thing I've noticed on my rewatch is just how useful Troy is portrayed in these early season 3 episodes. She's Picard's diplomatic advisor in dealing with the Shelyak. It's strongly implied she would have quickly solved the mystery of Kevin and Rishon unless incapacitated in the survivors. She can be an undercover agent with specific cultural knowledge in Who Watches the Watchers. She can telepathically monitor an away team and instantly know something's wrong in the Bonden. And she can even read the Ferengi's minds in The Price. A big step up from what I remember from seasons 1 and 2. When she would report sensing a vague feeling of hostility she couldn't quite interpret, just as the alien vessel would open fire on the Enterprise.
And then for the vengeance factor, she phoned it in. I'm sorry, continue.
Don't think this will continue for much longer, as TNG moves away from these character-driven plots to the technobabble plots of later series, where Troy is totally out of her element, finally culminating in the episode Disaster, where it's unclear why she's even allowed on the bridge at all. So I'm enjoying this new take on a character, at least while it lasts. Now, thank you very much for that, Endicore. Although I have to say, I'm sure people would agree, but I like Troy in Disaster. I know that, or at least I remember enjoying Troy in Disaster. We'll see how that comes up as we do the show, but I certainly see what you're saying there in terms of, you're right, she doesn't know what, is it a quantum filament they hit in Disaster?
Yes.
And yes. She doesn't get it. And then there's technobabble going back and forth, including with Ro Laren, who's, technically just out of a kind of refugee camp. And she's more up on the technobabble than Troy is. I certainly see where you're coming from. But I look forward to the episode. I think that's a good episode.
I do, too. I mean, you know, she listens to everyone's point of view, and then she makes a decision. I think that's exactly what she was supposed to do, given that she was technically a lieutenant commander and was in charge of the deck, while Data was giving birth to a child, or helping. Wait a minute, Data was there, wasn't he? Or was he trying to make it to the bridge? Yes, he was trying to make it to the bridge, wasn't he?
So Data was used as an insulator, right? As they had to cut off the electric pulse, and they took his head off. Yes. So sometimes when you say this out loud, it sounds ridiculous.
Doesn't it, though? Yeah. Guy takes his head off and uses it as a conduit insulator. Okay, so we end it with Captain Proton, otherwise known as Ben, the two of us need... No! I can't give my voice Michael Jackson high. He says, it's so nice to hear Detmer's. He calls him Detmer's voice. I love his dedication to the warrior way and the joy I hear in his voice when he speaks as the Klingon. Or as a Klingon. His perspective on the warrior race is so refreshing and welcome each and every time he comes on. Look forward to Sins of the Father. It's probably one of my favorite Klingon word episodes. He says, 5 stars for each and every... for each and every marketing in your logbook, Lou. My ratings will never change. Innocence knows best. Cheers to you all. Adios. As I will respond to that, Ben, for Brian. Kapla.
Now, am I right? I don't think we've heard from Ben for a while.
No, we haven't.
So that's good for him to be back.
But, he's slated to be back in a 3 episodes for Deja Q. Now, the last time he was supposed to be on, he completely forgot about it. Or he was nowhere. I guess he was busy. He wasn't available. So hopefully, Ben, we'll see you for Deja Q. All right. And that brings us to the end of the forum feedback for The Bondi. Until next week, take care and good night.
Yep, good night again.